Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam. Tato Jayam Udirayen. Nasta Prayeshwabhadreshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavati Uttama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. So chapter 2, that's page 91. Kamsa. A brief remorse. By Yogamaya's influence, the prison doors shut tight. The guards awoke and heard a newborn crying in the night. They ran to Kamsa shouting, Devaki has had her child! As Kamsa bolted out of bed, his scattered hair hung wild. While rushing to the cell of Vasudeva and his poor wife, King Kamsa thought, Now cruel time has come to take my life! He burst into the prison cell, eyes wide in great alarm, and saw his helpless sister, baby daughter, in her arms. Said Devaki, My brother, may good fortune fill your days. Great honor will attend you if you show this girl your grace. You've killed my 7 children due to force of destiny, but kindly spare this harmless girl. She'll be your gift to me. She clutched Yasoda's child and wept, but even as she begged, King Kamsa snatched the baby girl and gripped her tiny legs. Collapsing to his knees, he raised the girl above his head and braced himself to smash her on the floor till she was dead. The child, however, slipped away and rose up in the air, transforming to an 8-armed goddess. Kamsa gasped and stared. Bedecked in jewels, silks, and blooms, as angels sang her praise, she held 8 deadly weapons, such as trident, sword, and mace. The goddess Yogamaya, who was soon to gather fame as Durga, Devi, Kali, and a host of other names from avaricious people asking blessings of their choice, addressed the frightened Kamsa in a firm, impassioned voice. You foolish Kamsa, what will be the use of killing me when God himself, Lord Krishna, is in fact your enemy? He's taken birth already in a secret, distant place. Do not kill babies needlessly and add to your disgrace. To see this fearsome goddess and to hear her reprimand left Kamsa very humble, and he issued a command to free the blameless couple. Then he turned to them and said, Because of my most wicked sins, your 7 sons are dead. Because of me, dear relatives, your pain has been immense. Now what will be my destiny for such a great offense? The unembodied voice we heard misled us all and lied, but I believed it anyway, and all your children died. Though Kamsa blamed himself, poor Devaki felt no relief, so he spoke some philosophy to try to ease her grief. Your sons had their own karma, which they finished in this birth. The body's just an earthen doll that soon returns to earth. The soul, however, never dies, and those who know this truth stay unattached to worldly things and seek the absolute. Our family and social situations never last. I now see this quite clearly, though I haven't in the past. Dear brother and dear sister, you are both as good as saints. I've treated you so terribly, yet you've shown such restraint. Can you forgive a heartless wretch, so foolish and inept? With this, King Kamsa fell before his prisoners and wept. When Devaki saw Kamsa, so repentant and sincere, her anger at his sinful deeds completely disappeared. Then Vasudeva, who saw that Krishna's plan was taking place, was also freed from anger and affirmed with poise and grace. O noble king, What you have said is perfectly correct. Due only to their ignorance do foolish men accept their bodies as themselves. As such, they simply think in terms of all that they possess today and all they long to earn. The soul immersed in ignorance cannot be satisfied. When things go well, he dances, and when things go wrong, he cries. He always sees some problem or immediate reward, and never sees the all-controlling presence of the Lord. As all agreed upon these points of shared philosophy, King Kongsa took the chains off Vasudeva and Devaki. Much pleased by this conclusion, Kongsa took his sister's leave and entered his own palace, his anxiety relieved. The next day, though, King Kongsa called his ministers to see what they would think of Goddess Yogamaya's prophecy that he who would kill Kongsa had been born, but somewhere else. The ministers, great demons all, discussed among themselves. Emerging from their conference, their spokesman said with pride, "If this is true, King Kongsa, we must use infanticide. So let us kill each child who has been born 10 days before and save your precious life, O king." "Oh, yes, and what is more, the gods run in fear at the sound of your bow. Your arrows harass them wherever they go. Their weapons abandoned, their fighting all through, they either escape or surrender to you. Lord Vishnu finds yogis and hides in their hearts. Lord Shiva takes off for some forested parts. Brahma's meditating and Indra's withdrawn. The danger to you from the gods is all gone. And yet, like the smoldering ashes of fire, the gods may return to obstruct your desire. Destroy them this time, and your worries are through, and we shall suggest what your highness should do. The powerful Vishnu must first be controlled. He only survives where brahminical souls perform sacrifices and care for the cows. Great king, you must start persecuting them now. King Kongsa listened carefully to what the demons said and felt his pride returning as their statements filled his head. His humbleness and sorrow for his errors slipped away. He shouted, "Let the persecution start this very day!" The mystic demons cheered the chance to plunder, kill, and rape. They started to transform themselves to vicious, fearful shapes. They thought that killing Vaishnavas would save King Kongsa's head, not knowing that their own destruction waited just ahead. Joy in Gokula. Nearby in Sri Gokula, where the cows and cowherds lived, the gentle Nanda Maharaj was chief executive. Upon receiving word about his newborn baby boy, he bathed and dressed and gave out precious gifts in utter joy. He gave 2 million cows adorned with gems to Brahmin priests, along with hills of produce, golden cloth, and lovely feasts. Such charity to Brahmins made the kingdom purified. The Brahmins chanted Vedic hymns, and all were satisfied. Gokula's happy residents cleaned every nook and crag and decked the streets with mango leaves, perfumes, festoons, and flags. They mixed up oil and turmeric to make a golden salve and used it with some peacock plumes to dress the cows and calves. The cowherd men put on their jeweled turbans, coats, and silks that proved enormous opulence exists in cows and milk. Their wives, the gopis, all endowed with lovely hips and breasts, wore kumkum and vermilion and were very nicely dressed. The citizens, ecstatic at the news of Krishna's birth, brought gifts of gems and gold and other products of the earth. They blessed the heir apparent with fine oils and shouted out, "This child will rule our kingdom long and well, without a doubt." As drums and trumpets filled the air and festive spirits rose, the guests splashed milk and liquid ghee on one another's clothes. To satisfy Lord Vishnu through his servants, as required, King Nanda gave to all the guests the gift that they desired. Another wife of Vasudev, Rohini, had remained within the care of Nanda while her husband was detained. So she felt so pleased for Yashoda, she donned her finest dress. and wandered through the gathering to welcome every guest. The atmosphere in Nanda's home was naturally endowed with happiness and opulence derived from tending cows. But when Lord Krishna came within King Nanda's loving care, good fortune's goddess, Lakshmi, also made her dwelling there. Nanda meets Vasudev. Soon Nanda closed the festival, but he could not relax, for he was due in Mathura to pay his yearly tax. When Vasudev, his stepbrother, learned Nanda had arrived, he went at once to tell him how his wife and he survived. As Nanda greeted Vasudev, embracing him with love, he felt he had regained his life and thanked the stars above. The younger Vasudev showed his respects and then began discreetly asking questions on the state of Krishna's plan. Dear Nanda, at your age you'd lost all hope of having sons. It surely is good fortune that your heir has finally come. Good fortune also granted me the chance to see you here, for in this world it's often hard to see those you hold dear. The river's current brings together floating sticks and leaves, then spreads them quite indifferently by whirlpools, thrusts, and heaves. So, too, we come together due to bodily relation, then lose each other's company through time and complication. How are Gokula's fertile lands so blessed with grass and trees? How are the cows you raise so well? I hope there's no disease. How is my wife Rohini, whom you kindly shelter there? Is Balaram, our son, still doing well within your care? They're fine, said Nanda, but that wicked Kamsa killed your boys. At least your daughter reached the gods and could not be destroyed. By destiny your children came, and then were taken back. Dear friend, our fate rules everything. Take comfort in this fact. On hearing this, wise Vasudev could clearly understand that Nanda had no inkling of Lord Krishna's clever plan. He said, You are so wise and kind. Now, since you've paid your tax, before some danger hits Gokula, please, my friend, go back. So Nanda hugged his stepbrother, and, thanking him again, prepared to go to Gokula with all the cowherd men. They yoked their bulls to bullock carts, as was their simple way, and drove from Mathura back to the country right away. While contemplating Vasudev and all that he had said, King Nanda journeyed home with an increasing sense of dread. Within his heart he offered God sincere and fervent prayers to save his son and everyone from danger and despair. Putana. And danger was indeed upon Gokula at that time, from Putana, a giant witch, adept at every crime. Her master, Kamsa, sent her to destroy the newly born, so through her power she assumed a human woman's form. Her breasts were large and firm and seemed to overtax her waist. A fragrant garland dressed her hair, which framed her lovely face. She looked like Goddess Lakshmi, with a smile in her eyes, enlivened by her husband, Vishnu. Such was her disguise. Enchanted by her beauty, Yashoda and Rohini allowed the lovely visitor in Kamsa's nursery. She smiled at Krishna tenderly and held him to her chest, preparing him to sit and suck her poison-covered breast. Now Putana had murdered many children in her day. She looked at baby Krishna, but he looked the other way. And then she placed him on her lap, a terrible mistake, as one might think he holds a rope while handling a snake. So motherly was Putana, with wicked heart beneath, that she was like a deadly sword within a silken sheath. She pushed her breast in Krishna's mouth. Aware of all her sins, he sucked the poison and her life so she'd not kill again. The demon screamed out, leave me, suck my breast no more. But as she thrashed, Lord Krishna sucked her harder than before. So forceful was her screaming that through heaven, earth, and space, both men and gods thought hurricanes were surely taking place. She dashed out of the nursery with Krishna at her breast and tried to flee the village in her terminal distress. Her human cover vanished with her final shrieking sound, and when she fell, she shook the earth a dozen miles around. The cowherd women ran to see who made the awful screams, and found a giant, ugly corpse, like something from a dream. The demon's mouth hung open, showing teeth the size of plows, while eye sockets, like deep dark wells, appeared beneath her brows. Her nostrils were like gaping caves, her thighs like riverbanks. Her stomach was as spacious as a public bathing tank. Her giant arms and legs appeared like bridges in the sky. On seeing this, the women were upset and terrified. The hideous and evil Putana lay dead and still, yet something moved upon her breasts, which seemed as large as hills. The gopis, looking carefully, saw Krishna crawling there. Like any ordinary child, he played without a care. The gopis cried in happiness and kissed the baby's brow. At once they held some rituals with products from the cow designed to save the baby from what dangers might remain. And then they sang this ancient song comprised of Vishnu's names. May Ajja, he who is unborn, guard the legs of Krishna. May Mani Man, Almighty Lord, guard the knees of Krishna. May Yajna, Lord of Sacrifice, guard the thighs of Krishna. O Vishnu, Lord of everything, please protect this baby. May High Agriva, Horse Divine, guard the front of Krishna. May Keshava, he of fine hair, guard the heart of Krishna. Achyuta, you who cannot fail, guard the waist of Krishna. O Vishnu, Lord of everything, please protect this baby. May Isha, he who is complete, guard the chest of Krishna. May Vivaswan, God of the sun, guard the neck of Krishna. May Vishnu, shelter of us all, guard the arms of Krishna. O Vishnu, Lord of everything, please protect this baby. May Urukram, of giant steps, guard the face of Krishna. May Ishwara, who has control, guard the head of Krishna. May Sri Hari, who holds a club, guard the back of Krishna. O Vishnu, Lord of everything, please protect this baby. May Madhuha, the demon's death, guard the right of Krishna. May Ajana, who holds a sword, guard the left of Krishna. May Haladhar, who holds a plow, guard the rest of Krishna. O Vishnu, Lord of everything, please protect this baby. May Vishnu, Lord of Swetadweep, guard the core of Krishna. May Rishikesh, the self-controlled, guard the nerves of Krishna. Yogeshwara, Yogi Supreme, guard the mind of Krishna. O Vishnu, Lord of everything, please protect this baby. O Chakri, holder of the disc, guard before Sri Krishna. O Urugaya, with your conch, guard around Sri Krishna. Upendra, you of mighty deeds, guard above Sri Krishna. Garuda, eagle-feathered friend, guard beneath Sri Krishna. May Govinda, who pleases all, guard him when he's playing. May Madhava, the life of all, guard him when he's sleeping. May Vaikuntha, the undisturbed, guard him when he's walking. May Narayan, husband of wealth, guard him when he's sitting. The evil witches, such as this, who attack our babies, the ghosts and creatures of the night who can make us crazy, the hostile stars who make us live as we do not wish to, are vanquished, frightened, and repelled by these names of Vishnu. The gopis finished singing and were pleased to see the child appearing safe and happy, all the danger reconciled. As Krishna drank his mother's milk, the cowherd men arrived. When Nanda saw the giant corpse, he said, in great surprise, "My friends, we simple cowherd men could not see any threat, but Vasudeva advised us to take care. He was correct. He must be blessed with mystic skills and paranormal gifts to understand the threat at hand from demons such as this." Now Vasudeva, a Kshatriya, well-versed in politics, anticipated Kamsa's mood and all his dirty tricks. King Nanda, on the other hand, a simple Vaishya squire, could not conceive how Vasudeva had known what would transpire. The cowherd men brought axes and cut up Putana's frame. They reasoned, "Snakes are burned at death, and she deserves the same." By suckling Krishna, Putana had served him in a sense, and thus her burning body smelled as sweet as frankincense. How powerful is Krishna's service! Even with her faults, this Putana was blessed at death and gained a good result. If demons who serve Krishna accidentally are restored, then what to speak of devotees so pleased to serve the Lord? The fragrant smoke from Putana infused Gokula's air, attracting distant village folks to see the strange affair. How could a child have killed this awful witch, the people said. The simple Nanda, meanwhile, held his son and smelled his head. To hear accounts of Putana and Krishna, as have you, with fondness and devotion and assurance they are true, attracts one to Lord Krishna's endless pastimes, leading soon to sweet, ecstatic love of God, the highest human boon. Chinavarta. Said Vishnuratta, Master, all the pastimes God displays in endless incarnations and in countless different ways relieve the soul that suffers from illusion's painful touch, yet generally we do not like to hear them very much. The pastimes of Lord Krishna, though, as you describe so well, with Kamsa and with Putana and all you've yet to tell, attract my ear like nothing else. Each one is so sublime, I only wish to hear them all with my remaining time. Said Sukadev, Lord Krishna's mother, Yashoda, held the rites suggested by the Vedas to protect her baby's life. As demons in disguise planned new attacks upon the child, his parents just saw Krishna and enjoyed his charming smile. One day, as Yashoda sat holding Krishna on her lap, he grew so very heavy that she thought her thigh would snap. Unable all at once to hold the baby by herself, she put Lord Krishna on the ground and ran to get some help. The wicked Trinavarta then flew in from Kamsa's lair. Embodied as a whirlwind, he took Krishna in the air. He spun with fury, lifting up a swirling, dusty cloud that blinded people on the ground and thundered long and loud. The dust obscured the sun and made the day like dimmest dawn. When Yashoda returned with help, her baby boy was gone. She looked and looked, then others came to look on her behalf. When all had failed, she wailed, much like a cow who's lost her calf. As all the dust began to clear, the gopis gathered round and joined the stricken Yashoda, who wept there on the ground. Trinavarta, meanwhile, took Krishna higher than before, but Krishna grew so heavy that the fiend could rise no more. With Krishna hanging round his neck, Trinavarta then shrieked, This baby feels like chunks of lead or giant mountain peaks. He tried to shake off Krishna, but he struggled as he spun, for Krishna held on tightly and was having lots of fun. As Krishna grasped him by the throat, Trinavarta was choked. He could not move his hands or scream in fear or even croak. Trinavarta was frantic. Then, with grossly bulging eyes, he lost his life and started tumbling downward from the sky. Not far from where the cowherd women cried aloud and moaned, the body of Trinavarta fell crashing on a stone. His limbs were all dislocated, but there upon his chest the gopis found the infant Krishna, calm and self-possessed. As Yashoda embraced her son, King Nanda soon arrived, and all the cowherd men and women repossessed their lives. When Nanda saw Trinavarta was dead, he felt relieved. Then, standing with his entourage, he stated, very pleased, This demon took our child away to eat him, but instead the baby is quite happy and the wicked beast is dead. Because we've given charity and excavated wells, our pious acts are all paid back while he has gone to hell. The simple Nanda grew astonished, looking at the sight, and thought again how Vasudev had been completely right. First Putana, now this, he thought. Then, feeling quite amazed, he vowed to keep his baby Krishna safely in his gaze. Evil. Thank you. We are recording these recitations just of the chapters, so please excuse me for if you have a cough or something. Okay, before we get to the commentary, I wanted to make a couple of points and then ask for questions. This chapter is really interesting in the way it differentiates Nanda and Vasudev. You know, they meet, and then Vasudev knows everything that's going on, and Nanda is clueless. So he sends him to back to Gokula with a warning, you know, watch out for demons. Of course, Nanda has never seen any demons, so he has no reason to feel like there's going to be a danger. So then when these demons start coming, he's thinking, wow, this Vasudev has ESP or something. How does he know? So although it appears that Nanda is more simple and less intelligent than Vasudev, who knows all the tricks, it's actually Nanda's rasa is higher because he's completely in yoga maya all the time, and he can't ever imagine Krishna as God. Whereas Vasudev, if you remember, saw Vishnu in the cell. Krishna appeared before him as Vishnu. And so he goes in and out of his rasa with Krishna sometimes in the course of the 10th canto. Like later, after Krishna kills Kamsa, Vasudev and Devaki are freed from prison. But they've seen and heard all these amazing things Krishna's done, so they can't embrace him like their long-lost son. See? They can only pay obeisances. They can't give him a hug, even though they've been separated from him for years. So Krishna doesn't like this mood, and so he gives this very nice speech at that time to reawaken Vasudev's parental mood. So also this pastime with Putana is mentioned in a few places later in the third canto, and I believe elsewhere, about how kind Krishna is. And even so, though she approached Krishna to kill him, she got some degree of liberation. And I believe it's Vidura or Maitreya who makes this comment. Is it Uddhava? Uddhava speaking to Vidura. How kind Krishna is that even Putana gets liberated. So what to speak of those who try to serve Krishna even in some feeble way? And what to speak of devotees who are giving everything they can to Krishna's service? So this is the point. Krishna is so kind and so ready to reciprocate. Are there any comments or questions before we go on? Sure. Yes, subsequently. He's still free at this point. But Kamsa has not re-imprisoned him. But he has started the persecutions. This is, incidentally, very much like the Bible, the history of Jesus, that the sacred child is born, and then the ruling authorities use infanticide, and they try to kill all the babies that have been born in the last so many days or months in order to get to kill the sacred child. So, interesting parallel. Some people say that the two are connected, that the writer of one of the scriptures copied it from the other. Yeah, some of them say the Bhagavatam is not that old. Narada Muni asked Vyasadeva to write the Bhagavat Puran to tell everything about Krishna. Anything else? Yes, Tomodar. What kind did she get?
She became Dhatri, that the nurse of Krishna in the spiritual world. So that's, of course, assisting Mother Yashoda to serve Krishna. That shloka says that. Oh,
okay. Okay. Anything else? So, Raja Hari Prabhu.
Yeah. Hare Krishna. One thing I want to share is when Putana carried Krishna, and here Prabhu has written that he turned away, and it's also stated he closed his eyes. So in our acharyas and Prabhupada gave different reasons why Krishna closed his eyes. The first reason given is that he didn't like her face. That's what Prabhupada said. Okay, because she had killed so many children, so Krishna just closed his eyes. Second reason was because Putana actually hesitated. She felt something is not normal with this child. So she was hesitating to carry him just to assure Putana that it's nothing, everything is safe, just carry me. Krishna closed his eyes and acted like a child. Okay, then the third reason is because in the scriptures it is stated that killing of a brahmana, woman, cow and a children and a child is prohibited. So, but now Krishna had to kill a woman, so he felt, oh no, I have to kill her, and he closed his eyes. Okay, and another reason is because he genuinely felt the child, because Putana came to give milk, so Krishna felt the motherly love, and he behaved as a child. He reacted as a child. Okay, so this is one thing I wanted to share. And yeah, the second thing is what Prabhu has explained. It is not written here that she got the liberation. So yeah, that Prabhu has already explained that she became a nurse in the spiritual world. And also the point that is emphasized is that if one who performs a service like Putana can attain that position, how much more a devotee who serves Krishna with love and devotion can attain. Okay. And then before the Putana and the Trinavarta demon came, there was another short incident when Yashoda put Krishna to sleep in a bed, and then she went to do her work. At that time, Krishna felt very hungry, and he started crying, but Yashoda couldn't hear him. So Krishna was kicking his leg, and at that time there was a cart in front of Krishna, and by kicking the leg, he broke the cart into pieces. And when the devotees came, the elderly gopas and gopis came, and they saw the cart was broken. They didn't know how it was broken. And when they asked, all the children who were playing beside Krishna told that Krishna kicked and broke the cart, and they didn't believe. Okay, so it's an important point here, not only in the breaking of the cart, but also in all the pastimes, whenever Krishna kills the demons, the devotees does not want to believe that Krishna can kill the demon, because for them Krishna is always a child. And they try to always give different reasons. Okay, some of the reasons Prabhupada has explained is that, like for example, when he killed Trinavarta, the devotees thought that Trinavarta died because of his own sinful act, and Krishna was saved because he was pious. Okay, they also thought because of their piety, whatever good things they have done in their past life, that has given strength to protect Krishna. Okay? Some others thought because they always chant different mantras and they are doing different things to protect Krishna, therefore Krishna is being saved. So I think this is an important thing to understand, the mood of devotion that the residents of Vrindavan has. They don't love Krishna because he's God or he's the creator of the universe. They love him because he's just very lovable. Okay, so and also the way Krishna reciprocates to this, to the residents of Vrindavan, Krishna does not feel that he is God. He feels that he is a small baby, and he naturally acts like as a baby. He feels he is under their shelter. Okay, so this is the thing I want to share, that their love is not based on awe and reverence. It's based on sweetness and intimacy. Okay, so the next point is that another interesting point, it's stated in the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's book that when Yashoda was carrying Krishna, and Krishna became very heavy, and why did he become heavy? So this is before the Trinavarta demon came. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said that Krishna was thinking, if Yashoda carry me, she'll only lift me a bit, but now I have to play in the sky. So desiring like this, Krishna became very heavy, so that Yashoda kept him down. Oh, he thought, if Yashoda carry me, she'll only lift me a bit, but now I want to play in the sky. He wants to just have fun in the sky. So because of that, he made himself very heavy so that Yashoda can keep him down, and then he allowed the demon to carry him, and then Krishna had some fun in the sky. Once it's done, he killed the demon. So this also shows the nature of Krishna. He's not a god who sits very seriously and creating, and he's only into the business of enjoying. Okay? Yeah, that's true. Okay. Okay, and then another pastime which is not stated here is at the end of this thing when Yashoda was feeding milk to Krishna, he showed his universal form. Okay, and throughout these pastimes, Prabhupada also emphasized one more important point that Krishna's childhood pastimes indicates that God is always God. So Prabhupada says that there are some philosophers who feel, who explains that a living entity can become God after certain, after attaining certain level of enlightenment. So that is wrong because God is always God. He never becomes God. And one who is not God can never become a God. Okay? So this is the point. And I also want to share one last thing that each of the demons represents a particular bad qualities, anarthas. Okay? Putana represents, can anyone guess? Putana represents a pseudo sadhu, a pseudo devotee, a pseudo spiritual master, who teaches sense gratification and those things. Okay, so such person should be rejected. Okay, second, the cat. The cat is also sometimes considered as a demon. I think in Brahma the Purana it is stated a demon was sitting inside the cat. So the cat represents laziness. So if one is lazy, Krishna just give a kick and that's it. And third, Trinavrata represents he represents false pride because he was too proud, I'm strong, I can carry Krishna. So he's represented by useless learning, false argument, dry logics and reasonings. All these things are represented by Trinavrata, and by killing this, Krishna is killing these anarthas. That's all. Hare Krishna.
The Patana story last night I was reading in the Krishna book, and you picked out most of the stuff that's in it in this poem, so I actually thought it was pretty good. Even the part about the cows when she bathed them, because she just felt like Krishna is an ordinary boy. So, and it also kind of shows like the importance of cows and cow protection, that you know she bathed Krishna with the cow urine and smeared him with cow dung, and then took the dust of the cows that who's been walking in the dust and sprinkled that on him before she actually said all those prayers just to protect him. So I just thought that was pretty nice that you had even that kind of part of that in there. So I thought it was pretty good.
Thank you. You have to use a lot of poetic license, and definitely there's a lot of details that are omitted. So that's the kind of thing that I appreciate. The commentary on that and the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur commentaries, which are wonderful. So part of the challenge in presenting these pastimes to the public is the idea that they will take them as mythology. And mythology is an inherent part of every culture, from the Native Americans to the Greeks to the Romans. So there was a great scholar about 20 years ago, Joseph something. Anyway, he gave a series of talks and wrote books on the power of myth and the importance of myth for human beings. And he kind of elevated myth from something that would be just fantasy to something that's inherently important for human beings. But that still falls short of Krishna's pastimes. So in this... in this section, I've tried to address this for the new reader. I thought you might find this relevant. Are these pastimes mythology? So, Zach, would you like to read there? There's the mic. To read a couple paragraphs and pass it up.
The lotus on which Brahma finds himself comes from the navel of Lord Vishnu, an expansion of Lord Krishna, charged with providing forgetful souls with a field of activities. Lord Vishnu's instruction to his lotus-born son, Tapa, indicates that austerity and self-control enable one to escape this entangling material creation. Brahma understood this message and successfully controlled his mind until he came to see Krishna himself. In addition to filling up the universe, Brahma began a line of teachers to make the spiritual knowledge available to everyone. This distinguished line, known as the Brahma Madhava Gaudiya Sampradaya, continues to this day. You may well find this all quite fantastic and far removed from the realities of your own life. What relevance does what many would call the Hindu myth of creation have to you? The answer determines how much you will gain from reading the Bhagavat Purana. Let's first acknowledge a simple fact. If God exists at all, he exists beyond the reach of our present set of senses. Is that a limitation of God or of our senses?
What is the scope of our senses? Most of us have never been to Antarctica. Do we believe it exists? Why should we if we've never seen it? We believe Antarctica exists because we've heard about it from people who we trust who have been there. Seeing is believing, has its moments, but it would be foolish to limit what we believe to what we see, taste, or touch. However, by hearing, we share experiences far beyond our own. Learning by hearing from trusted authorities is called descending knowledge. Learning by personal experience or guesswork is called ascending knowledge. To ascend the ladder of wisdom means to rely on a very faulty set of senses and a fickle mind. For subtle spiritual matters, the descending method is easy and solid. We can quickly grasp spiritual experience in the company of those who have it.
These descriptions of Bhagavad Purana are far beyond our power to see. The narrow-minded dismiss them as myths. If we can be open-minded enough to simply hear them, we find that authentic spiritual sound has amazing power to improve our lives. We may have yet to fully experience God, but if we know the symptoms of those who have, we will recognize the ecstasy, the compassion, the wisdom, and the satisfaction of God-conscious people display. Then we can hear from and emulate them. As Brahma found out, hearing from authorities ends confusion and fear. Through a simple spiritual sound, Brahma discovered Krishna and found his destiny in his service. What about those who fight Krishna?
I think you're studying this in the Ishopanishad class also, correct? What are the four flaws of the conditioned soul? Imperfect senses? Cheating? Mistakes? And being an illusion. Yeah, there's a certain sequence there, at least. Imperfect senses, that makes one illusion, unless he makes mistakes, but then he presents himself as perfect, and that's cheating. Yeah. Because we have imperfect senses, we are unable to see God. This is the point. And yet when people want to understand God, the first thing they do is say, okay, well, God exists, you know, I'll find him. And he should show himself to me. And then they don't find him, then they get frustrated and say, he must not exist. And this is big scale, you know, scientific and public thinking amongst the leaders. Does God exist? Because we can't see him, he must not exist. So, any comments on this? Gopal.
At least one of the definitions of mythology is that it's something a group of people or a civilization believed at one time that people no longer believe. It doesn't mean it's not true. It doesn't necessarily mean it's not a fact. It's something a civilization believed at one time that's no longer believed. That's one of the definitions of myth. My point is that mythology doesn't mean false, necessarily. It means it's no longer believed, at least by most people. Most people probably think that myth, like Hindu mythology, yes, is false, but it doesn't necessarily make it false, though. Right. Well, I don't think I can beat your explanation that the proof is in the tasting.
I was just reading for a class actually in school. We had to read a part of Holy Cow written by Stephen Rosen, so it was kind of cool. I was reading about Prabhupada for school. It was kind of fun. And in that book, in that chapter at least, Prabhupada talks about how it's talking to cardinals and like Christian, like bishops and stuff. I think it's just cardinals. And he talks about how thou shalt not kill, how they have to become vegetarians and all that. And Stephen Rosen makes the point that Prabhupada never talks to them about the higher philosophies related to Krishna, and that he always talks about just like the basics of like how they have to become vegetarians first, because if they can't understand that, then they won't be able to understand the higher philosophies. So.
There was an interesting conversation between Srila Prabhupada and two disciples, and they were saying, we're going to the colleges and we're introducing Srimad Bhagavatam. And the professors see it, and they read how King Ugrasen was taking care of Krishna's family. This is at the end of the 10th canto. So Krishna had 16,000 wives, and then 10 sons by each one, and then each one of those had 10 sons. And Ugrasen appointed so many guards for every child. And they said, Prabhupada, the professors read this, and it goes into the trillions of people. And they say, they laugh and they say, where did they put the bathrooms? So Prabhupada said exactly that. Just introduce them to another part of Srimad Bhagavatam that they can understand. Like the first canto and second chapter full of philosophy. And they said, but Prabhupada, it's in the Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada said, again, just show them this, the simpler parts. And again, they were insisting. And finally, Prabhupada said to one of them, he said, you do not require a spiritual master. It was the only time Prabhupada actually rejected a disciple over this point. But wanting to thrust these advanced pastimes up front and not give the basics. So that's why we reserve our study towards the end of the semester here, so we're prepared and can appreciate it. Because the actual spiritual advancement comes from gaining a taste to hear about these things. That's very difficult for the average person. Take some purification. Thank you. Good point. Other comments? Yes.
Just to be a devil's advocate. So the point that you're making here is that because God is beyond the senses, we have to rely on descending method. So, but there are many traditions which claims to be offering this descending method. So if there are already these scriptures are already beyond our scope anyway, so how do we decide which descending method to take?
Just after that point, then I mentioned in there that the exemplar has to be there. The person who is setting the example of God consciousness through this methodology of descending here. So not just the method itself, but also somebody who's applied it and is getting the results that we want. So that's the Guru Shastra Sadhu suddenly.
So if you see other descending methods and then other exemplars, then what do you do?
We have to evaluate the results and see. And yes, obviously, if we want to be like this kind of person, then we'll be attracted to that. That's why.